Osiris.
Hey, my friend, it seems you guys are trouble care to share. Your time with me.
What's going on, everyone? This is episode 2 of the live show. I've relocated for my own safety to an undisclosed location, but Brian is in his place where he always is. Hi, Brian.
RJ, how are you?
Doing well. I'm doing well. It's a good day. It's a good day to be talking live tracks. You know what I mean?
It's a great day. It's like, it's a weird summer out here, man. In Colorado, it's like we had all this heat in early June, and we thought that we were going to be stuck with like 95 degree days for the next 3 months. But it's been really cool. It's been really great. Which, bringing it all back, it feels good for listening to the Dave Matthews Band. You know, it's the type of stuff that you want to listen to on the back porch when it's a little cool outside, and it works perfectly right now.
You know, today I went for a walk, and I'm at the beach, and listening to this show as a walk along the beach was really nice. It's good music. It's good music to walk to and to, you know, be in beautiful scenery. So Brian, we're going to talk about Dave Matthews again. We're going to talk about Live Tracks Volume 2. So yesterday we were in 1998. We are jumping forward to 2004, and this show was from September 12th, 2004, Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, California. I moved to San Francisco about a year after this show, and I have to say I saw some good shows in Golden Gate Park, including like Hardly Strictly Bluegrass and a bunch of other stuff. It's an interesting... I think this was the end of the tour, of the summer tour, technically, which is pretty cool. But I'm really interested to dig into this with you because there's a lot that I think is kind of different. Well, lots different from the show we talked about yesterday. But I guess what do you want to tell us about where we were in 2004, where Dave was in 2004? What do you have for us right now?
So, you know, I was thinking about this. I had just moved into like one of the greatest houses I've ever lived at in my entire life. And I feel like that house represented like a second wave for me of listening to Dave Matthews Band, because at some point around, I think it was 2005, that Some Devil came out, Dave's solo record. And we listened to that constantly during that period in time. But I was in, so you talked about being in your sophomore year of college in the 98 episode that we did yesterday. I was in my sophomore year of college in 2004. I was politically awakened. Like my whole thought of this summer and fall was, what is going to happen to our country right now? Are we going to be okay? And, you know, I don't know if we were, you know what I mean? I don't know if we were. I think back to it as a time that I learned a lot. I think back to it as a time that I like, I shed some naivety. I also think back to it as a time when I lived in Missoula, Montana, in one of the greatest places I will ever live in my entire life. And overall, it was a really good period for me. For Dave Matthews, it represents a really interesting period. And I think that we'll dive into this as we get into this overall show here. From everything I've read, this kind of is viewed as one of the last great years for the band. And I don't want to kick us off too early with too many fish comparisons, but from what I've been reading, this sounds like the end of the 1.0 era, if you will, for how we talk about Fish. That the band grew through the 90s. They had this really big commercial period. They had this really big kind of peak creatively and artistically. And this kind of finds them at the tail end of that as they're moving into a transition of what the band is going to be if they continue going forward. So it's really interesting in that standpoint, because you have these new songs, you have a lot of old songs that are still carrying the set list and trying to figure out kind of where the band is going. Not to give away one of the songs of the set, but where the band is going, you know, trying to figure out what that next step is really fascinating right now.
Yeah, I think that that makes sense. I mean, this in a lot of ways, this is compared to the show we talked about yesterday. This is very much like a song. It's a song focused show, which is what I would expect. Whereas like the Live Tracks one, we had a lot of improv and a lot of kind of, you know, just a lot of improv. And it seemed like this is a little bit different. And we should dive into it. I will say, when I was walking today, I saw a couple people wearing Dave Matthews Band t-shirts. So I feel like it was a good omen for us to keep this going. Also, Brian, I know you're a Topo Chico fan, right?
I am.
That's your go-to. So I think I've decided, I think Waterloo is the best. I think it's the best seltzer. I'm partial to Polar, like, because I spent some time in Maine and I really like that seltzer, but I think Waterloo might be the best.
Is that the black cherry?
Mm-hmm.
That's my, so we have Topo Chico on two levels of the basement fridge. Like we have a wet bar downstairs in our house. It's one of the great features of the house, which we utilized a lot until I stopped drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
And we have this great little beer fridge down there, and it used to have a lot of local craft brews. Now it's filled with Topo Chico and Waterloo. And I find Topo Chico is my end of day drink. It's like I'm opening my beer at the end of the day. It's got that same vibe to me. I relax a little bit. I sit outside. I throw some music on. I play with the dogs, play with the kids. Waterloo is my let's get through the day drink. That is my seltzer at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
That is very interesting. Okay, cool. My Waterloo is my get through the afternoon, and then I open a beer at when you open your Topo Chico.
My Topo Chico. It's the same. It's got the same mouthfeel. Yeah. It works. I'm still on coffee here today though. This is it's 10 a.m. here in Denver, Colorado. We're just we got a coffee and push on through while we talk 04, Dave.
We have to. And I have to say that someone on Twitter just mentioned my shirt, and I just want to say that when I left my last job in 2019, I swore off wearing collared shirts, and I don't wear collared shirts except for the Section 119 shirt that I have, because it's just too good. All right, so Brian, we're going to Golden Gate Park, September 2004, and it's a pretty historic venue in the Polo Fields. And I've been there; it's a big open area, but tons of stuff happened there. And I would like, do you want to give us a couple highlights of the Polo Fields?
Yeah, I spent like as we were preparing for this last night, I was doing a little bit of research and looking up the Polo Fields and Golden Gate Park, and like just going through pictures of it. It's such a gorgeous space in San Francisco, and it's such a San Francisco thing to do, to basically be like, we're going to set aside all of this land. It's all going to be public park access. This opened in 1870, inspired by none other than Central Park, which, you know, again, a great forward-thinking city to say we need to just, you know, put off this entire area of the city is going to be for people to enjoy. It's gonna be a public space. The Polo Fields here, which was the site of the show, hosted the Human Bean in the late 60s, a really big event that happened in the late 1960s. The Dead, Jefferson Airplane played there. There was a massive 1961 public rosary that had 550,000 people in attendance. A very different hang than the public the Human Bean. But it also had an anti-Vietnam rally in 1969. 1996 Tibetan Freedom Concert, and since 2008 has hosted the Outside Lands Fest. So this area of Golden Gate Park is really reserved for concerts and for gatherings, and it really worked out perfectly for Dave Matthews to essentially close out their summer with a show here at Golden Gate Park, which September in San Francisco just sounds absolutely perfect in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, when I lived there, I would say September, October were basically the best months. It's such a weird city for weather, but that's another, you know, that's another conversation. So what, like we were talking yesterday when we Live Tracks 1 was from 98, we talked about the fact that, you know, at that point you had to go buy CDs if you wanted to listen to music. By 2004, we're fully in the streaming era, pirating, like it's a whole new era in terms of music sharing and discovery. That probably has nothing to do with this show, but this show is very focused on like on songs, and I want to talk more about like the song selection as you said, but is there anything in the music world that was happening in 2004 that gives us any insight into this show or context?
I mean, I think that this was a period in time where you started to see festivals were really on the rise at this point. You know, Bonnaroo was in its third iteration. Austin City Limits had obviously been going on for a while, but was really drawing in a lot of large-scale acts. Lollapalooza was about to really take over. Grant Park in Chicago, another area similar to Golden Gate Park here in San Francisco. I feel like we're at a point, you talk about the streaming era and like pirating music. Like I just remember in 2004, especially being in college at that point in time, I had absolutely no challenge getting any music I wanted my hands on. And in most cases, regrettably in some senses, but you know, kind of just part of the time, I had no problem getting any music for free. Like if someone had a CD, that was super easy to get it burnt. If someone had a new release or a live show, it was really easy to get it passed along a large scale group of friends. So, I mean, I feel like these kind of combating ideas that work together in a sense of like festivals where you'd go there to see maybe three or four bands and then you discover a number of new bands. But also this idea that music was just as widespread and as accessible as possible. This is before Spotify. This is before Apple Music. This is really when music is kind of like, it's in a bit of chaos from an industry standpoint. You have bands like the Dave Matthews Band really carrying the industry forward from a live music standpoint. They're one of the bands that can really draw, 20, 40,000 people to a concert. I would say as well, you know, in a really interesting standpoint, this is around the time that you're starting to see the rise of blog rock and indie rock in the 2000s model. We'd seen the New York revival two or three years prior. Pitchfork was really the voice for people my age. I was 19 years old in 2004. I read pitchfork.com every single day. It made me feel as though I was on the cutting edge of where music was at that point in time. And I think a band like Dave Matthews Band was kind of at this point, we talked about it a few minutes ago, in transition. You know, they had really dominated what the 1990s were. They could draw tens of thousands of people to a concert, but where do they go from here? Where are they at in the larger music industry? I think is a really interesting question at this point in time.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's good context. And we should dive into the show because there's a lot to talk about. I do remember a couple people said yesterday that there were a few times when the Dave Matthews Band almost broke up. And I believe that someone said 2004 was one of them. Just as we go through this, I'm just curious if there's any like truth to that. We don't really, you know, no way to really know at this point. But also there is some, I wonder, releasing a live tracks, you know, a live release like this in one of those years, if that is true, I wonder where the band was at this point and where they were in that kind of like journey of decision making. Do you have any insight into that at all?
Yeah, and I mean it's interesting. Like initially, I think starting with like the live tracks release. So the live tracks release started on November 2nd, 2004. The second one, this volume that we're talking about, was launched on December 17th, 2004 for a show that happened four months prior. This kind of set this competing trend as you look at the next 10 to 20 volumes of the series of, is this a series that celebrates the archival releases of the Dave Matthews Band, or is this a series that promotes really big recent concerts? Because as you look ahead, you know, we have a 2000, a 96, 95 release coming up here in the next few releases we're going to talk about. But then you also have 2006, 2004, a couple 2007s, a 2008 later on. And in kind of preparing for discussing this series, it's clear online the sentiment within the fan base was, release the older stuff. Why are you releasing recent stuff? But at the same time, and you know, to kind of pivot in terms of this show and where the band was at and talking about this particular release, 2004, from by all indications, is like a boon period for songwriting for the band. And there's a number of songs on this record that would not make it to album, but would ultimately like define their live catalog around this period in time. My Actual Jam of the Show is one of those. But then they would scrap a number of these songs for their next record, Stand Up, which reminds me in a lot of ways of what they did in 2000 and 2001 when they were writing all these songs for what would become the Lily White Sessions and later Busted Stuff. But they scrapped those songs in favor of this like songwriting burst that Dave went on for Every Day, which was not as popularly received by the fan base because they were very tight, very poppy type of songs. They didn't sound like where the band was going in the live setting in these excellent shows in 2000. So it's this really interesting dynamic at play with where the band is at.
That is awesome context. Thank you, Brian. So, all right, let's dive into the show. So we get a One Sweet World opener, which is, again, like cool, similar to last time, yesterday, in that like it's, they take a while to move into it and they take their time getting into it. It sounds to me like the saxophone in the lead into One Sweet World, it sounds like kind of like a police siren. It's not like, yeah. It's sort of like, I think the charting of that was sort of interesting. I just wonder if that's like, if that's something that was a little bit like maybe do something different at the beginning there, but otherwise it's a good way to lead off a show.
Yeah. It's interesting because this is one of my favorite songs by the band. I think it's just iconic. And, to have a siren go in for a song that's about, you know, this idea of this like one singular space that we have, it feels intentional in the sense of like creating conflict and dynamics at the start, which I enjoy that aspect of it while wondering if it ultimately fits.
I think it's a good, I mean, it's a good opener though. And to me, I was listening to this last night. I was thinking, what would you say in So Much to Say, like Follow, right, in a row? And those are like among the best Dave lyrics and Dave guitar playing too, both of those songs. I think that's a powerful combo. And like, there's so much in those songs that you to unpack, but I just feel like that's a good set of songs.
It's a good set of songs, and I like structurally, you know, it kind of works similar to what we talked about yesterday in the Centrum show, where you have Seek Up as this opener, and then it goes into Linus and Lucy, and then it goes into Pantala Nagapampa and Rapunzel. And you kind of get a similar setup here where like One Sweet World is almost like it's your intro, it's your setting the table. What would you say, So Much to Say, Anyone See the Bridge, that jam segment that's attached to So Much to Say, like that, and then going into, again, Pantala Nagapampa and Rapunzel, you kind of get this like elongated intro section to the show. I always think of the latter two songs as like just very proper show openers. They set the table really nicely, and to get like four songs that build up to that, and then that, you know, by the time they end Rapunzel, it's kind of like, okay, you're all here. We can all take a deep breath. We can all, you know, enjoy the remainder of the show. Like we're here, but it's like a 20-25 minute, ultimately like setting the table for the rest of the night. Did you get that sense?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I mean, for the first time in like probably 20 years, I had these, what would you say, lyrics in my head all day, you know? Don't bite the mailman, you know, like it's just, they're so, it's such a, yeah, but these are very, I guess that's what I was thinking about. It's just like very song focused. There's not a lot of straying from these themes, except for the scatting. So how do you feel about Dave's scatting? And I didn't hear that at all in 98. And I guess he maybe picked that up over time, or maybe it was a phase, but how do you feel about the scatting in a bunch of these songs?
So I'm going to make a connection to a song later on. I really appreciate you asking this question, because I think it like sets a table for a conflict I continue to have with this band. And around this time I had this with this band, I kind of feel like by 2004, there was a bit of a shtick that was being leaned into. And I think the scatting, which you would hear throughout the 90s, but it felt very organic and it felt like it was kind of just a natural part of what Dave was doing, was now a part of the show. In the same sense that, like, later in the show, Jimmy Thing is always a song that, like, the first time you heard it, you kind of had like an older person telling you, like, wink, wink, this song is about getting high. And if you listen to lyrics, you're like, yeah, this song is about like smoking a joint, sitting back and just like being taken away. And like all your troubles are gone for, you know, like 35, 40 minutes, whatever. He specifically mentions getting high in this, which, like, I think about like 2004 America. By that point in time, it was like okay to say that you were getting high. It wasn't something you really had to hide. But it like adds to like that, the scatting, some of the song selections here. It feels in some senses like Dave Matthews Band is an institution by 2004 rather than, and I think this kind of goes back to the sense of like, where does this band go right now? Mm-hmm. Do you get that sense from the scatting? I'm curious, as someone who does not like vocal jams, what your thoughts are on scatting.
It's a little bit, I mean, I just think it's like an interesting choice. I don't think it adds, I don't think it adds that much, you know, but I don't think it adds much. I guess that's the main thing. But I will say that I know we're going to probably talk about this, but now that we're talking about Jimmy Thing, this is a good version. And we haven't even really mentioned Fish once today so far. Remember the Burlington 95 sit-in that Trey did on Jimmy Thing? Yeah. Remember, it was like the first Dave Matthews tape I ever got. And it reminds me of Trey sitting in with Goose the other night, hitting that one note in the solo where like the crowd goes wild. The same thing happens when he hits the solo in Jimmy Thing, and it's just like the whole arena goes absolutely nuts. And that's what Jimmy Thing jams remind me of. So unfortunately I had to say that, but that'll be it for today, I promise. So what's this song Joyride all about?
So this is a song that was recorded for the stand-up sessions. It's been played 72 times total, has had two significant bust outs, again, and this is like all still slightly new terrain for me, and I'm really excited to continue diving into this. The mindset around a bust out within the Dave Matthews Band fan base, which I'm just perusing this from reading online, is not how many shows it's been since something was played. It's how many days it's been since something was played, which is a totally different mindset than like how many shows it's been. Because if you think in the Fish world, it's been 350 shows since this last song was played. It puts the emphasis on the show being the thing. Like all the days in between don't necessarily matter. It's how many shows it's been.
Because it's probably tens of thousands of days in most cases.
It's thousands, yeah. And it's fascinating to me that the Dave Matthews fan community has put this emphasis on, it's been this many days since something happened. It feels, in my mind, slightly dramatic in a way that
it's sort of biblical.
It's very, it hasn't been like 250 shows. It has been like 780 days. Like, it's an interminable amount of time where like there were moments that the band could not even bust the song out. But I find that really
780th day he rails again.
I find it really endearing in a way that like it fits the way I approach music, but I found that to be really interesting. The song has had two very significant bust outs. It went from 6:24:06 to 7:08:11, and then from 8:30:13 to 7:12:2019. It has not been played since 2019. This song strikes me, this is in line with a lot of the songs that were debuted throughout the summer of 2004, that wouldn't ultimately make it on Stand Up. From all accounts, this song was intended to be on Stand Up. It made it onto the Australian release, but didn't ultimately make it onto the American release here. This sounds to me like everything I've heard off of the album Stand Up. It's very upbeat. It's very rocking. It's very positive in a lot of cases. which is interesting because when you think about the next Dave solo record, Some Devil, that's going to be a very like kind of tortured record in a lot of cases. So it feels almost like he's fighting against something writing a song like this, but this definitely felt like it fit in to the vibe of this show coming after this intro. What were your thoughts on
it? Yeah, it was interesting. The lyrics are, the song kind of reminded me of Everyday a little bit. And like I hadn't heard it that much. And like the lyrics are pretty cool. I like it in there. And it was like, it's a surprise to hear a song even from Dave Matthews that I don't know. And then again, like the show we talked about yesterday, into number 41 and the crowd goes wild again. It's like it's just a amazingly predictable thing. You can just like drop into that song and everyone goes insane. I think the yesterday we were talking about like Live Tracks Volume 1 and releasing your first kind of in a series based on a bunch of guests. But now like this show made me understand it better because a lot of these are just sort of more basic run throughs of songs, including number 41. Like it's still fun and you know, it's interesting, but nothing like what we heard yesterday with so much kind of different directions and really like kind of different kinds of improv. So gave me more context for that. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that, but I really like the like slightly slower tempo of Best of What's Around, like slower than the album version and other versions I've heard. I thought that segment was pretty solid.
I find that to just be one of the best songs that the band has ever written. It's got such a, like the chorus of it is, it's like equally sad. And also like the vibe of what he's singing about is really sentimental. And I just think it's such an accomplishment. And I love any show that has that song. I'm into hearing that song literally. And it's one of those Dave Matthews songs that like you put it in a set list. I'm not skipping past it. There's like that is one of my favorite just like traditional songs. But it is interesting what you mentioned about like the lack of improv on number 41, where you get the Everyday outro to that. It feels like around this time, like there's a lot of how do we bring in a song and kind of interpolate it into this performance rather than how do we explore outwards. And it's a very different approach to improvisation than we're used to. You had just on the screen, and I think it's worth highlighting, this is a good point from Brett Woden. Thank you for coming back and hanging with us here again, Brett. In the DMB world, what we call a liberation too as well. That is a bust out. It's not a bust out in the Dave Matthews world. It's a liberation, which adds to my theory of like this. It's so sentimental great. And dramatized. I love it.
I think that's awesome. I think the so to me, the Lie in Our Graves is moving on after this. I mean, Lie in Our Graves to me is maybe my favorite Dave Matthews song, especially just the way that it unfolds in a show like this. I mean, we haven't talked about this yet, but Butch Taylor is back on piano or still on piano at this point, and his piano playing in the Lie in Our Graves solo, like little build up thing, is just beautiful. Such a great, that's like kind of it's a highlight moment of listening to this for me.
Yeah, this song, I mean, this is right there with Best of What's Around. This is there with 41. This is there with Two Step, Seek Up. These are songs that like I could hear at any single show. It's wild. I was thinking about this. I have it in my notes somewhere. Like, this show feels like it's a run through of a lot of songs. And also these are the staple kind of jam vehicles that we have. And Lie in Our Graves is one of those songs that whenever they play it, like I would love to hear what a bad version sounds like just for comparison's sake, because it feels like one of those songs that the second they fall into it, they're going somewhere with it and they're going somewhere really special. I'm going to make the comparison right now. I think that this is the Dave Matthews Band's Harry Hood. You know, it's got that like sentiment to it that every time it builds up, you feel better at the end of it.
Yep. I think that's fair. I'm going to wait for the Dave Matthews fans to tell us that we're very wrong, but that's a good call, and I'm with it. I'm with you on it. That to me, I mean, that's a sort of an interesting part of the show. And the Stone, my wife knew that song was Stone. I didn't know that song. So I guess I don't know that many of their songs, but that's going to change as we go through this. But
the Stone is one of my favorite songs.
Is it? Okay.
It's really good.
Tell us about it.
It's just like, so we talked about this yesterday. Before These Crowded Streets is my favorite Dave Matthews album. And the Stone comes, I think, right out of the Halloween fade out. It's like the seventh track on the record. And it just like pivots towards this back end of the record where you get Dreaming Tree, you get Pig, you get just like a lot of like very dark kind of like layered multi-meaning lyrics in the songs, a lot of like a ton of parts like within each of these songs, crushes on the backside. And the Stone really sets the table for that. It's this just kind of, it's this dismal story that he's telling. The riff that Dave plays in it is it's repetitive, it's hypnotic, it like returns and ebbs and flows. Leroy is all over this song in just like a very, very heavy presence way. This song, whenever it opens a show, it feels like it sets the tone for a show in a really impressionable way. It will be the encore slot of the next volume that we're talking about, but I really like it here because it takes us into you know, a segment of the show where you get a lot of new songs, but you also get some improvisation and a special guest. So it really kind of seems like it bridges where the show is going at this point in time.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's that again, like the set list construction and the show flow is really pretty expert, you know. I want to talk about the Jimmy thing, but is there anything that you want to talk about before we get there? Because we have, like you said, there's a few newer songs, and then we get toward the end of the show, and the Jimmy thing is worth pausing on.
No, I mean, I think Drive In, Drive Out, you get like, we were talking about it yesterday, Carter is, it's a showcase for Carter. And then Loving Wings, this was my first time hearing this. It's a newer song at this point in time. Leroy Moore gives a Over the Rainbow, Somewhere Over the Rainbow tease midway through. It's a really pretty song. I enjoyed that before Where Are You Going, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, yeah. So the Jimmy thing, there's some For What It's Worth in there, which is cool. And a couple things, there's like some anti Bush stuff going on there, which is great in my opinion. And the other thing I hadn't, there's a great jam in here. And the other thing I hadn't thought about until listening to it for the second time this morning is, you know, during Leroy's sax solo on the Jimmy thing jam, I was thinking, is this like the next generation's E Street Band? Because I kept when I was hearing him solo, I kept wanting to like just kept thinking of Clarence and like the, you know, Jungle Land or songs like that, where he really drives a set of improv on a song. And you just don't hear a lot of sax solos in rock and roll these days. And it's there's like a lot of overlap in my mind between the two, but that might just be me because I like the E Street Band.
No, it's an interesting comparison. I hadn't thought about it, but like, I'm like going back in my head. I feel in a sense, like part of the appeal, like drawing to this, I remember, you know, talking about Springsteen, talking about the E Street Band with my parents when I was younger, and, you know, he was playing constantly in our house, and it was something that like, I was around Springsteen my whole life. It was all the music I listened to. And part of their reasoning for loving his music was it wasn't just straight ahead rock and roll. You had the grand piano up there. You had the organ up there. You had the saxophone, adding these various elements of American, like Americana musical sound, that both made his songs sound bigger, but also like showcase these instruments that aren't necessarily thought about in a guitar, bass, drums, maybe keyboard band type of thing. And I think part of the appeal for me to this day with Dave Matthews Band is that same similar aspect, that brass is a huge part of it, that strings are a huge part of it, that it's not just straight ahead. You were talking about it yesterday. They're the biggest band to ever not have a lead guitarist in their formative years. You know, are they one of the biggest bands to not have that, but then also really emphasize like a saxophone solo throughout a show? And I think to your point, it's huge here in this overall Jimmy thing. It's huge to have him, you know, really showcase what that instrument can do in a rock setting.
Yeah, it's really great. And then, you know, they get toward the end here. There's a few more tracks, but Carlos Santana comes out for Warehouse and a couple others. And I think the Warehouse jam with Santana is just really, really fun. And it also brings me back to the like electric guitar. You know, they do bring the electric guitar into the scene at some point. What this segment of three songs with Carlos Santana, what was your thought on that and your highlights of that?
Well, I feel like a broken record, but Warehouse is up there for me. Like, this is one of those songs I could hear at every Dave Matthews show. It's, I still remember the first time I heard it when I first got Under the Table and Dreaming. It's just such like a haunting song. It reminds me of The Stone in a sense of like this like hypnotic riff that keep going. And these lyrics that like, you just have to absorb yourself in. Also like a happy chorus to a really sad verse segment, like a really dark verse and like a very bright, happy chorus, which is a cool dynamic. But, you know, Carlos, we hear it whenever he and Trey play together. And it's really interesting to think that like just a year prior, he was sitting in for a full show with Trey Anastasio's band. And rather than feeling like he took over the stage, he does a really good job of like, you know, when you hear that guitar, you're listening to Carlos Santana, but he also wants to fit in with the overall band. He wants the band to be the focus and his guitar kind of be a part of it. And you really get that here in Warehouse, but I think where you get it the most is in the next track, Sugar Will, another one of the new songs that was debuted in 2004, ultimately did not make it onto Stand Up. It's his playing along with the band playing this very like mercurial, dark, kind of slow moving song. He adds such a dynamic to this overall performance, and to hear him play on both Warehouse, which I think he had played on before, but then also Sugar Will, and like how he can adapt with the band's songwriting and like their overall approach. And then obviously with Watchtower, which has such a huge space for a solo. It's just, it's huge for him. What were your thoughts on this?
I mean, if you think about the, you know, San Francisco, makes sense that, you know, it makes sense that Carlos would play there. But in this kind of a historic spot where there all these amazing concerts have taken place, like you were describing earlier, you know, it's really fun. And I think it's a great sit-in and does remind me a little bit of like the memorable sit-ins are ones where there are like, there's a lot of space, there's a lot of patience, there's a lot of like, you know, there's a lot of room. It's not just like come rage on the electric guitar. So I thought it was pretty cool. And I don't know. I think Carlos Santana is like he's a spiritual dude, you know. There's like something that's like very unique about him. I was talking to Aaron Magner from the Disco Biscuits because he got to play with Carlos in Hawaii when they did that Billy and the Kids stuff. And he said that he couldn't believe how like magical Carlos Santana was, you know, and he knew it too. Like he would just say one or two things and like everyone was just like, whoa, you know? So I think when he joins you on stage, it's like a different, takes everything to a different level.
I also wonder, you know, talking about like what we were saying at the top about this kind of transitional period that the band seemed to be in at this point in time, you know, Carlos Santana is now 5 years in 2004 from Supernatural, which was 30 years into his career. And, you know, to think about the conversations he probably had with the band backstage, you know, Dave Matthews at this point in time is 15 years into a career. It feels like a lifetime. They've gone to, you know, having number one albums released. They've gone to, you know, this like massive rise, being kind of a faux pop band, but also like in the jam band world, and like, where exactly do they fit in? And here they are kind of at this point where, again, you know, based on a lot of interpretation from the larger community, what's going to happen next? Where's this band going to go? And if you fast forward 4 years, they're going to lose Leroy Moore, one of their founding members, really tragically. They're at a point where like a lot of artists found themselves in the 70s, 80s, early 90s, who had been huge stars in the 60s and early 70s. People like Carlos Santana, of like, where do I fit in? What am I? Who am I? And I feel like one of the enduring lessons of Carlos Santana is be yourself, continue to create the music that you're making. Like, people will catch up, people will continue to follow you. The right people listening to you will always be there. And, you know, again, this is all my interpretation of it, but like, it's really fascinating to me to think about him playing with them at this point in time specifically, rather than when they were like young guns type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. They've all been through everything at this point. Speaking of going through everything, Brian, we have to get to our awards, because we're getting toward the end. There was an Everyday Too Much encore, which we can talk about if you want, but I also think we need to do our awards.
We need to do our awards. Our awards are, as always, here presented by Cash or Trade. Our friends over at Cash or Trade asked their members which Dave Matthews Band tickets were the hardest to get this summer. And the answer was a resounding SPAC, which always is. It's always the hardest ticket to get, because you got to be in the pavilion. Cash or Trade is giving away two pavilion tickets to Dave Matthews at SPAC to one lucky winner. You can enter by going to the link on the screen, cashortrade.org/grateful giveaway. Once again, that's cashortrade.org/grateful giveaway, not getaway, giveaway, for a chance to win two pavilion tickets to Dave Matthews Band at SPAC. And so we have three awards. They're back again here. Listeners out there, if you want to hear us give different awards, please feel free, write in, send us suggestions to OsirisPod, send us suggestions here in the chat. We'll address different awards, but we've got our bathroom break up first. What was your bathroom break, RJ?
I think probably Loving Wings.
That was it.
Yeah. I think it's that time in the show, and you know, just got like a little distracted and was like, okay, where is this all heading? Before it got, you know, before it picked back up with the Jimmy thing and all the that closing out of the show. So that's mine. What about you?
So mine was right after that. I think we would just probably end up going to the bathroom together, grabbing a drink, coming back, meeting our friends. Mine was Where Are You Going? This song represents my break with Dave Matthews Band. And I want to reference the antsmarching.org site is a fantastic resource. This has been so helpful for us as we've started this show. They have this feature on each set list. This is something I really want everyone over at fish.net to adopt, because I think it would be fascinating. It's called the show flow feature. So you can vote on whether or not you thought a song was a good move at that point in time. How this works, you vote on either a plus one or a zero or a negative one vote. And you can vote based on if you attended the show, if you didn't attend the show, and then they figure out, you know, the average of this for everyone who voted. Where Are You Going gets this, and you can look at this graph of like how people liked the show. And if you look at this particular show, people are pretty happy right up until about Loving Wings. And then the show drops off from Loving Wings, Where Are You Going? It hits its rock bottom, comes back up around Hello Again, then Jimmy Thing, Warehouse, Sugar Will. These are all pretty happy. And then you get a big drop off again at Stay, which I'd be really interested to find out why people dislike Stay. That was, I thought, you know, pretty good single that came off Before These Crowded Streets.
Yeah.
But
Yeah, that chart is pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. It's something that for other bands would be just amazing to have.
It's really fun to look at, and it's really wild to just see like the collective, like, we don't like this song. We don't want to hear this song. It doesn't matter where this song is played. We don't want to hear it. So Where Are You Going is unsurprisingly my bathroom break of this show. But again, we would probably just, we would hit the head and hit the food and beer line together.
What about your MVP?
My MVP is Leroy. I think throughout the show, he dominates on, you know, we talked about Love and Wings. We're walking towards the bathrooms, listening to a fantastic sax solo of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. He's great throughout the entirety of this show. Lying Our Graves, he's beautiful on number 41. I'm really, really into his playing throughout this point in time. And he's one of my favorite members of the overall band. And so like hearing him really shine is cool. What about you?
I think I got to give it to Dave. I mean, I think it's just such a song focused show, which sounds weird to say probably, but in contrast to what we listened to yesterday, which did have a lot of focus on Bela Fleck and on Tim, yeah, and on Butch. This is just like this, especially the first, I don't know, 15 songs are all like him, you know, with the singing, the scatting, the playing. A lot of them are guitar, you know, Dave guitar focused songs, and playing some new songs as well, which is, or newer songs, which is, you know, that's a lot of pressure. I think it really like just comes across to me as like he was kind of carrying it in some sense.
It's interesting to think about him because, again, like there's so much being written at this time. Like if you go, yeah, back to 2000 and you fast forward to 2005, like he's in a songwriting burst that probably rivals like his early output, but like the Lily White Sessions, then Every Day, then a few new songs for Busted Stuff, this whole batch of new songs in 04, and then Stand Up, and then Some Devil. Like the dude is just writing like crazy right now. And I think you're absolutely right. Like the creativity comes through like crazy with him.
Yeah. It's cool. It was a fun show, to listen to, but we're not done yet. Are we?
We're not done yet, because while this show was not as heavy on the jams, if you will, as, the night before, there were still some really cool moments. What was your jam of the show?
There were a couple that I was considering. I think the Lie in Our Graves, just the way that song kind of like builds back from the ashes, and the piano from Butch Taylor. It's a really great jam. And I think it's like a really stellar jam. So I'm going with Lie in Our Graves.
I don't think you could be wrong with that. Lie in Our Graves, again, like send me a bad version. I've never heard one that doesn't move me to complete tears. I went with Sugar Will. I really, really like this. And this kind of ties into something we were talking about yesterday. I really, really am curious to hear these batches of songs that I just completely missed because I moved on from the band. I moved away from the band. And a song like Sugar Will, I heard and I listened to again and then again. And I was like, this type of stuff would have kept me around had I been open to it at that point in time. But I was off. I was so deep in like seven or eight other bands at this point that I couldn't be bothered. And I go back to it now and I'm like, man, there's so much here. And Santana just adds so much to this overall, yeah, performance.
It's hard to not name something with Santana just because it's a really good, it's a good segment. The Warehouse is incredible. Watchtower is great. Those were all really good. So Brian, we're going to be back tomorrow, mm-hmm, and tomorrow we're going to talk about Live Tracks 3, which is from Hartford, Connecticut, from the summer of 2000. So we're going to go back a couple of years again, and there's some interesting stuff happening in that show that I'm excited to talk about. Everyone who's listening, watching, thank you. And we should have said at the beginning, this is available as a podcast. So if you're watching, you know, subscribe to the podcast, tell your friends. And if people can't make it, when it's live, you can subscribe and listen later, anywhere you get your podcasts. So just search for Absolutely. The live show. And, thanks to everyone who tuned in. Brian, anything else we need to say?
No, I all I'll say is I'm very, very excited about tomorrow's show. I've listened to the volume and I cannot wait to dive into this.
All right. We're going to leave you on a cliffhanger. Everyone needs to come back tomorrow at 12 or listen to the podcast. I will say that tomorrow's show flow chart shows very little dip.
Very little dip. With good reason.
For good reason. Apparently, we're going to find out tomorrow. Thank you guys. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you guys soon.
See everyone. Do you and me have a better time than most can remember? Better than the best, so can pull on through while there are tears and eyes. Whatever holds us down, and if nothing can be done, we'll make the best of what's around. That really matters, yeah. And hurts not much when you're around, but when you're around, and if you hold on tight to what you think is your thing, you may. Osiris.